Welcome to Relatable. Happy New Year. Let's go 2021. We're happy to be back with all new episodes. And to start things off right, we have a great interview with Sean McGinley, who is a writer, director, and producer. His accomplishments are many in all three categories. Among them, he wrote and directed The Great Buck Howard and also directed and produced the Brothers documentary, which focuses on the impact of losing a brother during 9/11, which Sean also experienced. I thoroughly enjoyed this conversation, and I'm sure you will too. If you're curious about the entertainment industry and what it takes to be successful, or you want to hear about someone who takes multiple risks while staying true to his values and core beliefs, you can't miss this interview. Sean is vulnerable, open, and candid. This interview is a real gift. Enjoy this episode. So tell me a little bit about, I have so many questions for you, and I hopefully won't keep you too long, but.
No, ask as many as you want. We have time.
Oh, awesome. Okay. So maybe let's start, what are you currently working on right now? Like maybe just talk a little bit about what a day in the life is for Sean McGinley.
It changes. You know, right now I'm working on a film. Typically I'm not. Typically like a day in the life is I wake up, I have breakfast, I screw around online for a while reading news and doing a crossword or whatever. And then hopefully somewhere in the course of all that, if I can get 2 or 3 hours of writing done, that's a really good day. Mm. Then it's get some exercise, have dinner, watch TV or a movie. If the writing's going really well, after dinner there'll be more writing until bed. But that's only when things are really cruising, you know. I'd say, you know, most of the time is spent, you know, pacing around my house, calling people on the phone, you know, going down some rabbit hole on YouTube with Rodney Dangerfield or whoever. I mean, just like ridiculous. It does feel at times like, what am I doing here, man? Like, this is not a life, but I've been doing it for 25 years. And so I've just kind of come to accept that this is kind of what it's like.
Are you a writer first? I mean, we'll talk more about all the different things you've done and accomplished, but would you define yourself as a writer first?
Yeah, absolutely. Like yeah. When I first moved to LA, the idea was, you know, I want to be a screenwriter. I want to, you know, make a living writing. And that was where the focus really was. At the same time, you know, it was the mid-90s, and I don't know how familiar you are with films and stuff like that, but at the time there was a real movement for indie film,
right?
And so I was really consumed by that as well. So at the same time, you know, every time I got a chance, I'd cobble together whatever money I could and make a little independent film. And that's become more my focus now. But for the longest time, I was just like, if I can make any amount of money writing anything, you know, yeah, that'll be good. But that's changed.
Did you have a degree? Like, what was your degree in at Villanova?
Philosophy. this came out of nowhere. Just to like give you like I was not a serious student in high school or college. I wasn't one of the smart kids or one of the artsy kids or anything like that. I was kind of just a goofball. You know, I liked to drink and chase girls and you know, just be a dick basically. And, at some point in college, and I don't know where it came from, no one from my family is artistic or writes or does anything like that. Somewhere in college, I just became consumed with films and with writing. Huh. It hit me out of left field. It was like falling in love or something like that. Like I became overwhelmed by it. And so after I finished college, I moved out to LA with just like, I didn't know anybody. I didn't know anything. I was just like, I'm going to be a writer. And I had no clue where to begin. I didn't have any friends. It was such a weird thing to do. And my parents were furious with me. They weren't speaking to me. You know, it was a really weird thing. And then by some miracle, it was just like, I don't mean, it was such like a shady thing, but I applied to USC Film School, which, you know, I'd been told that's a really good film school. And I got in, and I mean, I have to figure they made a clerical error or something like that, just because, you know, like you needed to put in 3 recommendations. I didn't have any recommendations for film school. I forged my recommendations to USC. and got in and went there. And so I do have a degree, an MFA in film production. I don't really think that helped much, though. I think it really was just, it just was some sign from God or something that, like, okay, you know, keep going with this. Because, so it did give me that.
Wow.
That's the only real education I have.
So in terms of leaving home and going out to LA, I mean, that's kind of scary and not knowing anybody. What gave you were you someone that didn't have much fear, or you're able to face a lot of, like, that to me is like a huge move. So what gave you the courage to do that?
Yeah, I had an enormous amount of fear, and I was not like an intrepid sort of person. I'm not sure. I go back and forth on this, and some of this comes from therapy, was that on the one side, I was honestly like captivated by films, and I knew if I wanted to do it, I needed to go to LA if I wanted to do it seriously. Like, I'd known people that tried to do writing while being another job, but I felt like if I did that, I'd wind up falling back on, you know, the safety plan. And so there was a real passion there, and even when I went to USC, I was expecting to meet more people like me, but I didn't. You know, I was by far the most on fire person there, the person who would really, like, there was nothing else in my life. I didn't go out on a date for years. I didn't go out. I didn't do anything. All I did was watch films, try to write films. You know, it was really, I meant business. The other side of the coin is that, like, something that's, you know, really my whole life, but not really, not until college that I have an understanding of it, is that I've had some depression. And that's something I've struggled with. So if I'm looking back at it now, I think there was some part of me that felt like I need to do something big. I need to do something monumental, because if I do, that'll cure this. So I think that was partly driving it too. But I had every reason not to go to LA, you know, just because I had no money, and I wasn't somebody who could arrive in LA saying, like, look at these bona fides I have. You know,
right.
I was just like, I arrived in LA with just like, I've never written anything. I don't know anything. You know, I don't have any talents that are special or anything like that. I just was like, I want to do it. And so, you know, I think part of it was just like, I didn't know what else to do.
It's so interesting when you said you weren't, well, this is, I'll, you tell me if I got this right. When you were talking about yourself in high school and college, like, you weren't necessarily a great student, or, you know, you were kind of messing around a lot. And the fact that when you made this move, then you were so dedicated and connected and doing something that meant so much to you. You know, I talk a lot on this podcast. The heart of this podcast for me is about people talking about their journey and their path and how they navigate that. And one of the things that I feel, and I hope that young adults listen to this podcast and get some refreshing information from those of us that, you know, weren't necessarily superstars in that time period, which used to mean if you were, that you would be greatly successful, right? If you were great at school and you went to great colleges, and if you had these talents and you knew what you wanted to do, at least in the Northern Virginia area, you know, it seemed like you and I were friendly with kind of the same types of people. And then it's like to do what you did and then to find this passion, and then what you just described, where you just hunkered down and you were so focused. I have to think it's partly because it was so interesting to you and meaningful to you and fulfilling, that I don't know how, if it felt like work to you or if it felt like it just was right because you were so connected to doing it.
Yeah, it never felt like work. And I always felt like if I could make this happen, you know, there have been times where I've made really good money from writing something, or even like this last film I made, which I financed myself, but it was an enormous amount of work for, you know, for a really small film. You know, every day is just like, I feel like I've robbed a bank, you know.
Just,
I feel like I'm really getting away with something.
Yeah, I don't know. It's so cool though, because I think too, even though you love it, you still probably have to put in a ton of time and you have to be dedicated to do that and to go there. How long, I guess the question I have, how long after you got there did you have your first, what you would characterize, like, taste of success, and what was that?
Well, here's what happened. So I went to film school, and when I began film school, I thought, like, okay, this is my ticket. Again, I didn't understand the way the entertainment industry worked. I thought it was like medical school. If you got into the top medical school, you're going to get out and be great.
Right.
And so you get there, and that's the first thing they tell you is just like, this is a different kind of business. You know, most of you guys are not going to do well in this business, you know, but begin film school. And so
we'll take your money for film school.
Pardon me?
We'll take your money for film school, but the correct. Chances are,
that
yeah.
That was a lot of money.
Yeah.
All on student loans too.
Yeah.
And so what happened was, you know, I started writing and was writing and writing and writing and really living, you know, an incredibly poor lifestyle. You know, it was getting the rent every month was such a nightmare. I was late for my rent constantly. Like I always had, you know, there were many times where I went to the ATM and I couldn't get the money out because $20 was the minimum. You had to get at least 20. I didn't have 20 in the account.
Yeah.
And so it was like, it was years of that. And again, like by then my parents had started speaking to me, but my father was just like, what are you doing? Like you got, this is not a life. You know, you know, years were going by. I was like 28, 29, 30. And he just was like, you know, where are you going with this? Just because I really couldn't make anything happen. And I finished lots of scripts and sent them around and tried to get people to read them and they wouldn't. And I made films on my own, which, you know, played at a few festivals and then went nowhere. And so it was really just, persistence and continuing to write stuff. So I wrote a script that was, you know, I didn't think it was any different than any other script I'd written. And I knew a manager. He wasn't my manager, but he was a manager who managed people. And I said to him, will you read this? And he said to me, he goes, yeah, I don't think it has what it takes, you know, keep trying. And I basically just, we were friends. And I said, out of friendship to me, will you send this out to a handful of places, studios to see where we're at. And so I was 31 at this point. And then like the dream happened, you know, like everybody got really excited about it. And it became kind of like a hot script in town and it sold. And I made $100,000 on that, which was more money than I had made in the previous 10 years combined.
Right.
You know, I was living on $8,000 a year, $12,000 a year, you know, it was like, it was nuts. And so then that began a whole sort of a thing where I was making a lot of money and I got a big time agent and I was living sort of the life that I had, you know, imagined I would live when I, so really just all my dreams came true overnight in that way. And it was really exciting.
That's so cool that that you pushed and that your friend did that on your behalf, even if he didn't think it was entirely ready.
Yeah, trust me, he was the first one to say, like, okay, listen, I was wrong, man. Like, you were right, I was wrong. Like, because the reaction was just, like, it was weird. It was universally positive. And, you know, and it was also kind of surreal because, like, you know, I'd be walking into offices with people, and they're like, you are such a talented writer. Why haven't I heard about you beforehand? I'm like, I've been around for 10 years, man. Like, you know, I don't know why you haven't heard of me, but that's just the way the business is.
In the 10 years that you were writing and submitting, because I feel like there are a lot of people, one of which is my husband, who I think you've at least spoken to once or twice, that does a fair amount of screenwriting on his own, and he keeps plugging away at it. But for those 10 years, other than the resilience and the persistence, what counsel do you have for people? Because, you know, what's prompting this question is I had a conversation with someone earlier today about networking and how a lot of people shudder at networking or think that networking is like a dirty word. And I suspect in LA, it's a big key to how things get made or things get pushed through. And so in those 10 years, are you building relationships? Are you proactively networking? Are you consciously trying to broaden that net for yourself?
No. So there's an article, I read an interview, there's a screenwriter, his name is David Koepp. He's like one of the top screenwriters in Hollywood for the last 20 years.
Yeah.
I read an interview with him early on and they asked him, they're like, how much time did you put into like going to parties, going to networking events, that sort of thing? And he said, as a writer, I cannot think of a bigger waste of time.
Uh-huh.
He goes, you should be writing. And trust me, when you write something that's good enough and when you write something that has potential, people will read it and you'll see the difference. So that's what I found. Any networking I did was just like making friends. So the guy that took out that script for me, he was just a friend I made, you know, in a sincere way, you make a friend.
Right.
And, you know, and of course, like if I came across anybody who could help me out, you know, great. But I haven't found the networking that I've done to be
that's
things
interesting.
That led to success for me.
And do you think that's unique to, well, I would say that's untrue for like the corporate business world. So do you think that's unique to the entertainment industry?
I think it's more unique to writing.
To writers.
I think there's plenty of jobs, like if you're an agent or a producer or something,
right.
Which I'm not. So there's probably, you know, if you interviewed one of them, they probably talk a lot more about networking, that sort of thing.
Okay, and then here's one more question on the script. So the script that you submitted that got all the attention, one question is what happened with that script and did it become a movie? Or I'm interested in the life cycle of that. And then the second question I have is, did other material that you've written, was that surfaced and then purchased in some capacity?
The script that I wrote was called Mulligan. It was like a kind of like inspirational sports movie, like Rocky or Rudy, mm-hmm. or one of those. It never did get made. But off of that, you know, just in the wake of that, I had like another 5 jobs that I got, which were really, you know, high paying jobs, like through my agency and everything else. The other thing is that I had written another script on my own that I showed to my agents that they, you know, and the only reason I was in the door with my agents was because of that script. And they, then that script did get made into a film. It was called The Great Buck Howard. It wasn't a big, huge hit, but it was a big thing for me in my career and getting to make it and having, you know, I worked with some amazing actors on that thing. I got to direct it. That was like a descendant of that first script I had sold.
Yeah, so I definitely wanted to touch on that because I would say there is a great, you know, following for that film and it's extremely well known. And I'm curious, just back real quick to the first one that you sold, was there any sadness that it wasn't made? It like once you write something, is, you know, you want to see that come to fruition. I suspect it's part of the artistic process. So for that not to happen, or are you like, I just scored the big check and that's kind of what I've been waiting for, now all this other stuff's happening and so you're just moving ahead?
I think like now and like maybe like 5 years later, there's some sadness that film didn't get made, because I think it would have been a good film.
Yeah.
At the time though, it was really intense, man. Like from the moment like that script hit, I was in meetings almost every day with like different studio executives and different producers and people that like I'd heard about and seen on TV and stuff. It was like really, it was crazy the doors that were opened, you know, in the wake of that. And so for about 2 years, it was such an exciting time. And also like I was walking into offices where people were like, we want to hire you to write this idea we have. Will you do it? You know,
wow.
And here's a lot of money. So it was like, I didn't think about it much right then, because just what was going on was just so, it was also very satisfying, just because like, you know, I'd had so much doubt through all that time.
Yeah.
Just like, is this all just an illusion in my head? And so it was the fulfillment of that. And also, you know, a big part of what drove me through my 20s, which probably wasn't healthy, was that, you know, I wanted to show my parents that they were wrong. So a lot of that came up as well, and just showing them that, you know, you were wrong to discourage me. You know,
right.
Look, here's the result.
How is your relationship with them now?
It's good. You
yeah.
know, it was actually good then. It was just like, you know, there was a year or so there where things were very rough. It just, you know, a lot of that anger just sort of fades away, and it's, you know, especially with my father, it's sort of just like, it's a Catholic Irish sort of father who just
mm-hmm.
is, you know, and all the success I had meant nothing to him. He still treated me like a, you know, like his punk son.
Mm-hmm.
So that's just, that's the way it's just, and then you get older and you just learn to accept it.
I also went to LA in about 92 with aspirations of being an actress. And I met with my dad, who's also Irish Catholic, and I'm the youngest of 5. And I had just graduated from college and had like a job at a gym and a job, you know, and I was like, this is what I want to do. This is what I want to pursue. And I went to meet him. He worked downtown in DC. And I remember I took him, you know, we went to lunch and I told him that I was moving to LA to pursue this. And I purposely did it in like a crowded restaurant so that there wouldn't be like things thrown at me or, you know, whatever. And very similar reaction of like, what was that? What are you even talking about?
And I have friends here, though, who did the same thing, and their parents were just like, fantastic, go out to LA, have a great time, follow your dreams. You know, I'm not a parent, but if I were, I'd want to be the parent that did that. You know?
Yeah.
There's absolutely nothing wrong with a 22-year-old going to LA and chasing something.
Right.
Like, it's so crazy. It just, I was treated as if I had told them I was going to go get into porn. You know?
Yeah. It's so true. And then it's funny because when I went, I ever really did was extra stuff, but occasionally you could see me and, you know, they would watch it and record it. So it was this really odd, like I'd come home and he'd be like, what are you doing with your life? But then at like parties or people or friends, they'd be like, oh, she's on TV. Not that I was really doing anything, but it was this very kind of bizarre time. But I agree with you. I think that like, you know, his whole point of view, he was a depression kid and he, I think, was scared for my security, but also like, you have to be a contributing member of society. That was his big thing. I was like, well, I can contribute artistically. So yeah, tell me.
The same way, but like, I don't buy that just because I know too many people here whose parents, you know, came from as humble a background as mine did.
Yeah.
They still had the perspective to be able to say, go for it, man.
Yeah.
Like, have a great time, you know, and see what you can make happen. I think you can do it. I believe in you. My parents were like, you're an asshole. You're not going to do it. And just accept it and go get something safe. And I didn't like that. I resented that.
Yeah. And maybe to your point earlier, like it was a little bit of a drive to make it happen.
A lot bit, man.
A lot bit, yeah.
I was consumed with it. That's why, you know, that's why I started going to therapy. Everything. It was just like, I was consumed with anger and this desire to like show people, and that's a lot of what drove me, and it was unhealthy. It was something that I had to really work hard to get past.
Yeah.
Realatable is sponsored by Teresa Freeman Associates, your one-stop shop for soft skills development, speaking, coaching, and workshops. If you'd like to hire Teresa, visit www.teresafreemanassociates.com for more information.
Tell me a little bit, just because you touched on it, about the Great Buck Howard, like, because that process of, and interesting, like, how did you become a director, go from, because you wrote and directed that, right? So maybe just tell me a little bit about how that came to fruition, and then, you know, working with some of those people, like, again, is it something that happens fast, or how did that take off for you?
It happened really slow. Now, I had directed two films before that.
Okay.
Which were not big hits. They like played at film festivals and that sort of stuff. And I directed a film called 2 Days in the early 2000s that Paul Rudd was in. Paul Rudd wasn't a big star at that point, but he was known, he was something of that. So like, I'd spent time with him. There was another actor in it named Adam Scott, who's gone on to become a pretty big actor. He was in Parks and Recreation.
Yeah.
So I'd spent time with actors who were good actors and who were somewhat known actors. So I had a little bit of comfort with that, but neither of the films that I'd worked on previous to Buck Howard had any kind of success, apart from like playing at some cool festivals. So when I sold that script, I got an agent. They're like, "What else do you have?" I showed them The Great Buck Howard, and my agent liked it and showed it to a very senior agent at CAA, who had me into his office, and he said, "I think we can figure out a way to make this, but let's talk about a strategy and make it happen." And he said to me, he goes, "Listen, we represent Colin Hanks, and he's looking for something to do." And he had had a hit movie out at that time called Orange County, so he had some sort of, you know, he was hot at that point.
Mm-hmm.
And also, they're like, and you never know, if we can get Colin to do this, maybe we can get, at the point, Tom Hanks had a production company called Playtone, which was producing films. Maybe we can get them to produce it. So that's kind of what happened. Is Colin read it just, you know, without an offer, nothing happening. It's hard to get an actor to read something until you can tell them, like, listen, this is happening. It's real. Like, we're going to go make this, and, you know, we have the financing behind this. But he read it just as a courtesy and liked it. And then we met. And then we said to him, like, how about if we show it to Playtone? And he goes, don't think that they do things just because it's me, because
mm-hmm.
I bring stuff to them all the time. They don't do it. You know, they do what they want to do. But anyway, they did say they wanted to produce it. And so then I thought at that point again, you know, and then I went in and had a meeting with Tom Hanks, which was just like mind blowing. I was like, what the hell is this? And it was really just, it was so trippy. But again, I thought like, Tom Hanks is going to get this thing financed. We're going to be in production tomorrow. But the thing that you find is, like, Tom Hanks' production company doesn't finance films. They just say, hey, we'll put our name on it, and we'll be, you know, we'll guide it through production, but you still have to find a financier. So that took years. And also the lead role was the great Buck Howard, and so we had to find who that one was. So we went through a number of different things. At one point, Kevin Kline was going to be the star of it. Mm. And I actually went to New York. I spent a whole day in Kevin Kline's apartment going through the script with him. You know, at the end, he's like, okay, let's do this. I want to do it. And that was the trigger. We had a financier who said to us, if you can get Kevin Kline, we'll give you the money to make this. So everything gets started. We're getting ready to go. And then Kevin Kline's like, I thought twice about it. I don't want to do it.
Oh, so, man.
That was like, you know, so then there goes like another year where we're trying to get it made. And then a different financier came on board and they gave us a list of names. If you can get one of these names to play Buck Howard, we'll make it. And so it was John Malkovich who wound up playing Buck Howard. But again, I flew to Boston where he lives. I, you know, met with him for breakfast. It was like, you know, I'm sitting there in front of John Malkovich. It was nuts. And then we got to go, you know, once he was on board, we got to go make the film, which was like amazing. And also it was like, the film before that I had made for a budget of about $300,000. This film was a $10 million budget.
Wow.
So it was like, it was such a head trip. You know, there were, you know, I walked onto set the first day, there were 80 people there. You know, there's like 20 trucks lined up with campers and all this stuff. It was really crazy and intense and, you know, a lot of fun. I've never had that big of a budget again, but it was fun to do it once.
Did you have any fear of, can I do this? Am I going to deliver? Like, it's a pretty big stage and there's a lot riding on it. Does that?
Yeah, I felt that in a huge way. Now also just like, because Tom Hanks's production company was the production company behind it, we had really great people in all the key crew positions. So like my cinematographer was this guy named Tak Fujimoto, who was like, you know, he's done like 40 films. He did all of Jonathan Demme's films. He did a bunch of John Hughes films. He's like he did The Sixth Sense. He's like a, you know, a veteran, highly respected, like Hall of Fame kind of cinematographer. And it was the case with every crew position. So I was really concerned about that. I think the key to it all was how I was able to get through it was that on the first day, just through kindness and because he's a good guy, John Malkovich he deferred to me. He listened, like when I said something to him, and I was worried I was gonna, you know, I'm like, how do I direct John Malkovich?
Right.
The guy's like forgotten more than I will ever know. But when I said something to him and asked him to do something, he goes, okay, yeah. And when everybody saw that, just everybody else kind of fell into line. And so, you know, after the first day, I knew like, okay, I can do this. I have control over it. But I felt very vulnerable, and I knew too that had John had an issue with me, or had he decided not to be kind to me, that I might have gotten fired, you know, just because it was such an intense place to be. And I had no business there. It was really just through luck that I was there.
It's interesting. I wonder too, as you're in that experience and you start to just, you know, obviously you wrote it and you're connected to the material, and to go from being a fan of these people or someone externally on the outside looking in, and now you're inside and it's actually part of something that you're driving, does it become really about the work and what you're creating? Like, I would think you get more distance from the fanboy perspective. Is that true?
Yeah, I was never a big fanboy for actors. I was always more of a fanboy for writers.
Uh-huh.
Or for directors. So
I
think,
see.
Like my first AD was Richard Linklater's first AD. And in pre-production, at one point he handed me the phone. He goes, hey, it's Richard Linklater. He wants to talk to you. And I froze up. I was like, I mean, I just got off the phone really quick because I was like so freaked out that I was talking to Richard Linklater. So, you know, with Malkovich, I admired him a lot, but I wasn't a fanboy. So it wasn't like, there was never anything where I was fawning over him or anything like that.
Right.
You know, he was very down to earth. I was surprised, just because beforehand people told me Malkovich can be kind of difficult, he can be kind of tough, and he never was with me. He was always really sweet to me and really kind and interesting and liked talking about politics and sports, and you know, so I never really had after the first couple of days with John, I never really it was more the only thing I felt weird about was just like, I was like, how do I direct him on his acting?
You know, right.
But once he said to me, like, you know, once he responded to my direction, I was like, okay, cool, we can do this. And really after the first day, I was like, you know, there's a lot more people here. It's a lot bigger stage, but it's the same stuff I've done on the other films.
Right.
So once you got that, it was just, I wasn't nervous after the first day.
And then how do you, just once the movie's completed and you know, the editing and all of that, and it's about to be premiered or shown, how nervous or how connected are you to performance, like, of the film, and are you at all concerned about numbers, or is it like once it's created and you've finished it, you kind of move on to the next thing?
Yeah, it was a long editing process and a long post-production process for a bunch of reasons that are boring. We premiered at the Sundance Film Festival, and I wasn't prepared for that. Like, I wasn't prepared for the amount of attention. Like, I remember we were in a room, and they're like, okay, you guys, let's go. We got to walk. Some people are going to interview you. And a door opened, and there were like 100 people there, you know, ready to interview all of us, primarily John and Colin. Right. Emily Blunt, before she was famous, was in this film as well. But she was kind of like a hot, young, sort of it girl.
Mm-hmm.
So primarily they were there to interview them, but also me. Tom was there as well. So they were there, you know, so I was like a secondary person, but I wasn't prepared for that level of attention, and it really did kind of freak me out. And I was really, really nervous about all that. And I, you know, in a lot of interviews, they Colin was making fun of me. He was just like, Jesus, man, like, you really, you know, you're such like a nicely spoken guy that you get in these interviews and, you know, you're stuttering, you're swallowing, you're blinking. You know, I was really uncomfortable. The film, I wish it had done a lot better, and I think it could have done a lot better. Again, there are reasons that are boring why it didn't. I was so freaked out by all this. I remember at one point when I was at Sundance, you know, and I'm not religious at all, but I'm like, God, please, just get me mostly good reviews. If you get me mostly good reviews, like, I'll never ask for anything else. So the reviews were mostly good. They're like three quarters good. So I got what I asked for, and
right.
it didn't do much business. You know, it played in like art house sort of theaters, and a lot of people saw it on a plane. I can't tell you how many people were like called me and emailed me, and like, I was on a plane and I saw the Great Buck Howard. That's not how I dream being seen. But again, just like as the year, at the time I was a little disappointed, but as time has gone on, I've seen how hard this business is. It's still the biggest thing I've ever done. So
yeah.
I wish I had been more appreciative of it.
That actually just perfect segue to like, how do you, I mean, it seems like you've had this roller coaster. And so how do you stay interested or resilient or like the amount of rejection that you have to face? Like, I, you know, one of the things that I have three boys and Missy has four kids, and, you know, they're not faced with a ton of conflict really. So we talk a lot about building resilience or having, you know, situations where that's going to help build character. And I think you're in an industry that it's just so harsh. And I just like, how, what kind of toll does that take? Or is it just, you love the process so much, or you love writing so much, and it just, that sustains you?
Yeah, I mean, I think like I just naturally had, I was naturally not deterred by rejection from the beginning. So, you know, this is something I saw a lot in film school, is that people couldn't finish things because they couldn't bear to have be told that what they had written was not good.
Uh-huh.
Or to be rejected. And for whatever reason, I was a locomotive train. You know, I never, you know, if somebody didn't like it, I was writing the next one. And it's harder with the films just because you put more of yourself into the films and you work so hard on the films, the ones that I direct, I mean, that it starts to feel like I've just worked so hard on this. How can, it has to be successful just
right.
because, you know, but it's not. And so that's something that I've had to like, over time I've just become inured to it where I don't even feel it. You know, it's just the rejection is just like, okay, let's go on to the next one. I just want to make another one. The truth is, you know, I in the midst of all this, you know, I love doing what I do and I love making these films. And I've just accepted that the best part of it is when you're making the film.
Mm.
And everything else is just not as much fun. And, you know, even when we were doing Buck Howard and it got into Sundance and we were playing at Sundance, like, it wasn't like I was enjoying any of that. I was freaked out and nervous. And,
right.
you know, the best part was when we were making it. And every film I've done, the best part is when you're making it, and everything else, you know, good or bad, is it's not why you do it, you know. And it took me a while to realize that, because I dreamed the day would come when the whole world would be, you know, blowing me, but like that hasn't happened yet.
So when you, and then any of these films that you've done a lot now, and I'm curious, I think I've heard this, but I'm curious from your perspective, where while you're in that, you know, whether it's 30 days, 2 months, you know, shooting, and you're in that process and everybody's connected, and then when it's over, does everybody just scatter? And is there like you're kind of I don't know if family is the right word, right? But you're all together and you're all working on this thing. And then like, I would get so attached to everyone. I mean, I get attached to my kid's teacher, right? Like by the end of the year, I'm the one that's crying because this year's over. So do you feel like you have all this connection, and then does it dissipate? Or is it like, just like in life, like sometimes you might take one or two friendships from that and say, yeah, we really jived and we have a relationship beyond that.
Yeah, it's something that happens, that people in films talk about, that like you very rarely stay in touch with somebody for long. I have worked with people again, you know, who I've worked with. So it's kind of like my cinematographer that I work with now, we've made three films together. Mm-hmm. And in between, like maybe, you know, we've gone to dinner at his house, to go to a Dodger game. Maybe that's happened four times in 8 years. The only times we really connect are when we come together to make a film, and those are great. And every time we're like, let's get together, let's hang out, but yeah. we never do until the next film. But most people you just don't see again, and it is kind of sad, and you do get kind of attached.
Yeah.
Maybe there's three people in my life who I met on a film who I've stayed very close with, but that's the exception.
And then you just mentioned, I think, that you invested your own money in this most recent film. Is that right?
Yeah, my last two films I've invested, I paid for myself.
And how like scary is that? And I mean, I don't know much about the industry, but I thought I read like you're never supposed to put up your own money. Is that?
But that's true. It's the worst investment you can make. You know, maybe that and a restaurant are like the
right.
worst things you can do. It just came down to, you know, in both cases, I had a film that I wanted to make. It wasn't a film that had like neither of the films were like had real commercial potential. They were personal films, and in both cases, just in weird ways, some money had fallen into my lap that I hadn't expected. And so when the money came, I was like, you know, I can put this money in the bank, or I can, you know, I just felt like it just would be a shame to take this sort of found money and not use it for something special.
Yeah.
So I've never regretted, you know, putting the money into films, whether or not if they were successful and made their money back or not.
Yeah. So maybe we could talk a little bit about, we just passed the anniversary of 9/11, and so sorry for the loss of your brother during the attacks of 9/11. I saw a bit of the documentary that you directed, and maybe just talk a little bit about that experience. I mean, it seemed like it might be cathartic, I don't know, but just, you know, I just can't imagine. I'm one of five, so, you know, I'm sure that was really difficult and probably still is, but... You know, to the extent that you're comfortable, I'd love to hear about that experience and what that was like for you.
Yeah, sure. I'm perfectly comfortable. I was 29 when it happened, almost 30, and it was really like it was a blow, and I was not prepared for it. I'd never really lost anybody, and especially like that, you know. And
yeah,
apart from the violence, just the hardest thing was that he kind of just vanished. You know, like we never found his body. I never got a chance to say goodbye, anything like that. There's a friend of mine, a dear friend from high school, who Joe also knows, named Mark Foley, who died of cancer about 4 years ago. And it was interesting to compare the two, just because he got sick with cancer, but I got to go be there with him. I spent like the last month of his life with him in his living room watching him die. And it was terrible for him, but it was better for me, just because you go through a process where you get to say goodbye to him. I got to tell him I loved him, you know, and it just, by the time he died, I was ready for him to die. I wanted him to die. He was so sick. It was terrible.
Right.
So with my brother, it was hard, just because you never got a chance to say goodbye. He's my younger brother. So, you know, I was taught to protect him and look after him. And it was just a situation where you just couldn't. And so I never really, you know, it's true what they say, you know, you never really get over it. I think it stayed with me. It's a painful part of me forever. And that you do, it was weird just because when it happened, I was like, I never want to lose track of him. I never want to stop hearing his voice, you know, but you do, you know, I wanted to think about him every day, but now there, a month goes by where I don't really think about him. And that's kind of, it's different than I expected, but it was like, it was a blow. You know, I was never the same. And, you know, I think really my parents too were never the same, especially my father. It was just, you know, I would not wish that on anybody, even like somebody you really hated.
Right.
You know, it was far more painful than I would have anticipated.
How many siblings do you have?
I have two. So, my brother Drew, who's still alive, and then my brother Mark, who passed away. They're both younger siblings.
And so how long after 9/11 did you direct that documentary?
We started about not quite a year later. So we started like in July of 2002. And we just went all around New York and New Jersey interviewing people, other men who had lost their brothers. And we did it, I think, till like the end of October. Then I went back to LA, and then it was like another 5 or 6 months of editing it, just because I'd never done a documentary before, and I had about 100 hours of footage. And while I was doing it, I didn't have a plan for like, what's this, you know, how are you going to put this all together?
Right.
So it was like a real job figuring out how you take the 100 hours and turn it into something that was a film.
If you'd like to advertise with Relatable, please email us at info@tfreemanassociates.com.
I can't imagine, you have your own pain that you're dealing with and your own grief, and then you're talking to all these people in similar situations. So maybe there's some solace in those conversations, or is it just that much more sad and depressing, right? Because you're experiencing it over and over for different people too.
Yeah, it was sad and it was depressing. At first I was really excited to talk to these guys and share with them. And it was also just, it was good for me just to, it gives you some perspective and
right.
You see that there are people, like I interviewed a guy who lost two brothers. You know, I interviewed a guy who, you know, I interviewed a number of guys who like were roommates with their brothers and saw them every day. You know, my brother lived in New York, I lived in LA, so it wasn't like I had to walk in the house and he's not there.
Right, right.
And there were people that were in a lot more pain than me. And that was good for me. But over time, it did start to take a toll, just because it was just a lot. Because a lot of these guys, you'd go there and they'd cry the whole time. And,
yeah.
And just day in, day out of that was rough. So I wouldn't have wanted to go any longer than I did.
Yeah.
But I've never really looked at these things like I don't, like anything difficult or painful, like I prefer to talk about it, and I like to kind of like to look at it. I don't like to
bury it.
Yeah, or to like, you know, not want to see it. You know, and even with stuff that's not personal, like anything, like I want to see it, you know, and I want to know all the facts and confront it. I don't want to ignore it.
Well, I think just, you know, with you putting that out into the world, I can't imagine like how much that probably help people or other, you know, people in similar situations that lost loved ones, that there's something that, and I don't know if commemorate is the right word, but at least it's not forgotten, right? There's this thing that lives forever that I think gives it a tribute, right? That sort of something, given the harshness of it and the fact that it happened so quickly.
Yeah, that was the idea. For me, like when it was over, I think the biggest thing was that the guys who were in the film, there were 31 men who appeared in the film and talked about losing their brothers. I felt like it helped them, especially like maybe not all of them, but I think a few of them, it was a really important experience for them to feel like someone was paying attention to them and they got a chance to tell their story and talk about how they felt and just express how much they loved their brother and missed their brother. And so there were a handful of guys who, when I left, I felt like that was really valuable. Like they needed to do that.
Yeah, for sure.
That was like the most rewarding thing that came out of it for me was these guys. And really, you know, I really loved them all, you know, just because even though I spent anywhere from an hour to 5 hours with them when we filmed it, like when I was editing it, I spent, you know, hundreds of hours with them.
Right.
I really grew to like just love these guys so much and feel such a a kinship to them. And there are a handful that I'll still email with from time to time, or that I'll see on the, I go to New York, not this year because of COVID, but every year I go to New York for the anniversary with my dad. And so I'll see some of them there. And so it's just, I really love those guys.
Yeah. I was just, that was one other question was, you know, do you still have connections? So that's nice that there's a bond there, or that, and you have that opportunity to revisit, even though it's not a great, it's a sad situation for sure. How do you, so you said you, if you, a normal day, if you're not filming something or you, like you're writing 3 hours a day, how do you pick things you want to do at this point? Are you still commissioned? Like, do you, could you be working on three different things at one time? Or now is it to your, like these last two films were projects that you personally motivated to complete, and so you're driving everything? Is that, tell me a little bit about just now where you are, like how you figure out what you want to work on.
Well, there was like probably about 5 years ago, there was a change in my career, which was kind of important, which is after Buck Howard came out, you know, it was another sort of run, like when the script first sold, where I was getting offered a lot of jobs, and I got a bunch of, in a row, like of high paying jobs, more for television than for film at that point, because television was starting to be bigger.
Right.
And television pays really well. But again, it was a bunch of stuff in a row that I wrote and was, you know, paid stupid amounts of money for, and then that didn't get made. And, you know, so the years were going by, and I'm thinking to myself, you know, I wanted to be a filmmaker. I wanted to be someone who wrote stuff that got made. I didn't come out here to be, you know, a rich guy who, you know, just, you know, is like kind of a technician or, you know, a gun
right.
to hire or something like that. And so, at the time, you know, I was kind of in demand and I was making money. But I kept saying to myself, I kept saying to myself, like, you're really wasting your time, and you're not doing what you came out here to do, unless you're writing your own stuff and trying to make your own films and say something that's singular and personal. And I kept saying to myself, you know, Sean, if you had any balls, you would stop taking these jobs and you would just write stuff on your own and try to make it, or try to take it to market and sell it. And I didn't do it for a while. But at a certain point, just I did start doing that, and it's been difficult. You know, I thought when I finally broke away from all that stuff, and it really caused problems with my agents eventually were just like, we can't help you. You know, you're not doing stuff that we want you to do or that we think is a good use of your time. And you know, these big agencies, they have a nut they have to make. You know, so they
right.
need the people that they're spending time on to be bringing in a lot of money, and it, you know, they didn't want to go this journey with me, so they were just like, you know, we need to go our separate ways, which I was fine with. So like, I've made a bunch of stuff, you know, some stuff that I financed, some stuff that I found other people to finance, which has not been, you know, they haven't been like big hits. But I've kind of just had to resign. What I've basically resigned myself to in the last few years is that I'm going to do films that I want to do. I'm hoping one of them is successful enough that, you know, other people want to hire me to write things that I can make, you know, some money on, so I can kind of like, you know, because it's been, you know, I don't have the money that I had 5 or 6 years ago. You know, it's tight, you know,
yeah.
just trying to, and so, but my focus is just on making these films. So maybe 5 years ago, I made a TV pilot that we weren't able to sell, but that I think is great. And then I just did it. I wrote it, shot it on spec. We raised the money from a financier. And then about 3 years ago, I made a film that one we did get our money back on, but it didn't make a lot of money, but it was bought by DirecTV and it played on DirecTV. And this film that I just made was a really small thing, just that we shot because we thought it was something we could do during COVID safely. And you know, who knows if we'll get our money back on that one. I feel much more like I'm on the right track. I feel more rewarded. I feel more like a real writer. I don't feel like I'm a workman, you know. I feel like I'm trying to be an artist, which is what I wanted to do.
Yeah.
So most of what I write now is stuff that I think I could either find the financing for or finance myself for a small amount of money. And it's stuff also, it's not really concept based. Like a lot of stuff that I wrote at one point was, they were like commercial concepts. And when you come up with them, you're just like, shit, you know, I hope somebody else doesn't, you know, come up with the same idea, which happens from time to time. Whereas the stuff that I write now, I'm like, there's no way anyone else could come up with this idea. Like, I'm taking this from my observations or directly from my life or from experiences I've had. And so I'd say like I'm a happier person now, but like a poorer person.
Yeah, I think it's such a hard thing. I mean, I applaud you for doing that. And I agree with you that when you stay kind of centered to your soul and create from a place that is personal to you, the right things happen. But I can imagine the draw or the fact that you've been in these different pockets, and it's nice to have security and it's nice to have money and to know that you could like pull that lever, but yet lose some of that centeredness.
The hardest thing, yeah. The hardest thing about it, the hardest switch in it was when you're writing and you have an agent, and then when you know, and every time you sell something, they take you out to dinner, you know, and people call you and email you and mm-hmm. congratulate you, and you feel like you're part of something, you know, you feel like you're part of a system, you know, and so much of writing, you feel like you're off on your own and no one cares if you're doing it or not. And so that was the hardest part about it. It wasn't so much like the money, you know, one of the reasons why, you know, the money wasn't satisfying to me is I had nothing to spend it on. Like, I don't like cars. I don't like, you know, I'm not, you know, I have a nice apartment, you know, and I don't need a big house. I don't have expensive tastes, and I didn't know what to spend the money on. I don't have kids, so it's not like I have to put anybody through private school or anything like that. So the hardest thing was just like, was letting go of feeling like I was in a system, feeling like there were people that were validating me, and that, you know, I had to validate myself. That was like, that was the hardest thing.
And I've heard, I mean, I'm married to one, but it's so isolating to be a writer. And like, to your point, like you're so much of it is just you're on your own. And then it is a work of art. And then if nobody's seeing it or reviewing it, or you don't have the community after, and I can't imagine having it and then going back to not having it. That's gotta be really tough.
Yeah, that was the hardest thing about it. But it's been a few years now, and I kind of have just accepted that, like, this is my lot. You know, and the other thing is that you have to accept, or I've had to accept that, and I've had to go at it with my father about this too, is that, like, this is the wave I've chosen, and I'm riding this wave into the beach, and you know, hopefully it goes well, and if it doesn't, you know, I'll still be okay. You know, I'm not going to starve, but... I just had to accept it.
Yeah. And I think, you know, a lot of what we talk about on here is this idea that like you're navigating your own way and you're figuring it out and you're making decisions based on your experiences. And there's not just one way to reach that success. And I say that in quotes, because I think there's lots of ways to feel that. It's not always like that commercial version of it.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, trust me, I as much as like, you know, I'd love to have a lot of commercial success.
Yeah.
The thing I'm always saying to myself is just like, is that I have to be removed mentally from results. And so I'm always saying that. It's just like, I can't be concerned with results. And especially with writing, just because there are people in writing who think they know a way you need to do it that's going to result in money or success or whatever. And I don't know, man, I think it's a bit of a con. You know, I think writing, you have to write something that you love writing. Like, anytime I've ever said to myself, yeah, I'm going to write something really commercial, you know, at the end it's turned out bad. You know, the times that I've said, this is an idea I really am into and passionate about and excited to write, like, those are the things that have turned out the best. Those also have been the things that have been the most successful financially as well.
Yeah, for sure. So as you think about your career, I'm going to ask a favor. One of my passions and platforms, and the reason actually that I left corporate business, is that I'm carrying a flag and a crusade around soft skills development, because I feel that even in adults in business, I was seeing as an HR person a lot of gaps in people's ability to communicate effectively, to frankly present effectively, to influence, to collaborate. And it was really becoming an obstacle to people either going into a leadership role or even, you know, worse, like just getting promoted, because they'd spent so much time on technical development, whatever that technical skill is. And then I have three kids that are in this world of technology, and I'm seeing an even bigger gap in our young adults, their ability to do these things. So I'm curious, in your work and in the entertainment industry and what you've described, the kind of stuff that you're involved in, if you had to pick a couple of soft skills that you think are critical or that people need to have developed, what would they be?
What do you mean when you say soft skills? Like, what do you mean?
Yeah, so I think of people as, like, if you think of someone that's technically competent, right, in architecture or in coding or even in art, or they, you know, when I think of a technical skill, I think of it as the subject matter of which you're growing your acumen around. And then when I think of a soft skill, and those are like technical or they could be called hard skills. When I think of a soft skill, I think of it, your ability to interact with people. It's really your interpersonal skills, your ability to effectively communicate both verbally, but also looking someone in the eye, being able to actively listen to them, like these nuanced skills that I feel like are kind of a dying breed.
All right. Now what's interesting with both writing and directing is that I've seen people who have success who don't have the skills you're talking about. So, and there are all different kinds of people that get into writing and directing. And some of them, it's typically men who are, they're just sort of like bullheaded. Mm-hmm. And, you know, every time they make a film, it's a misery for all people involved. But sometimes the film turns out good, sometimes bad. So it's different kinds of people. For me, for writing, I think the most important thing is to be vulnerable and to be comfortable with being vulnerable. I think that's where the ideas come from, and I think that's where the depth in the work comes from. For directing, the most important thing is listening, because all you're doing is listening to actors, and it's very, very important with actors, if you want them to do well, to know how to treat them. It, just like one of the things that some people will do with an actor that's very bad is they'll, like, whatever, like, if you don't like what they're doing, they'll say it very loudly so everyone can hear. So wow. It's important when you're talking to an actor to go over and quietly whisper to them so only they can hear what you'd like them to change. That just came naturally to me, just because I was just I could imagine how difficult it is to act. I can't act, so I'm kind of like amazed by actors.
Right, right.
I think it's just, you know, and with the crew, I think it's very important to listen. You know, it's very tempting when you're directing a film to become like a tyrant and just say, you know, everybody's got to do what I want. So there are people that are there to help you, and if you can stay calm and listen to them, they can help you and make the film better.
Yeah, I'm such a active listening, and listening in general, I feel like, is a skill that people could spend a little more time developing.
It's interesting for actors. The best actors that I've worked with, and Malkovich was such an example of this, is they really listen. Like, when they're in the scene, they're not just waiting to say their lines. Like, they really listen. And the way they do their lines, this is every good actor I've ever worked with, the way they do their lines is really impacted by what the other actor has done. Like, they're really listening to it.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just, it's something like you really feel their presence there, because they're listening in a way that not everybody does. You know, so much acting is just the person's memorized their lines, they're waiting for the person across from them for their mouth to stop moving, and then they're gonna say their lines. So the best actors are the best listeners.
Yeah, cool. All right, and then as you think about your experiences to date, and, you know, you think about young Sean, is there any advice that you would give yourself in terms of, you know, how to traverse sort of the tricky waters or the things that you've had to throughout your life? So if you were just going to give advice to a younger version of yourself, or to someone that is a young adult in college or, you know, high school, what would you tell them?
I would definitely tell everybody, and I do tell anyone who I meet this age, is I'm like, really, really try hard to find something that you love doing, and don't worry about like how unlikely it is that you'll be successful, whatever it is, just because it's a great gift to give yourself to spend your life doing something that you're passionate about and that you enjoy, and also that you can enjoy even if you're not successful at it.
Right.
So that'd be one thing. To myself, you know, I don't know if this would help if I could have given this advice to myself, but I really didn't enjoy so much of what I was going through, just because I was freaked out about money, or I was angry about my, you know, people that had regarded me as highly as I thought they should have. And so I guess what the most useful advice I could have given myself was get into therapy sooner. Because when I started therapy when I was 29, I went for about 12 years, and it helped me a lot. And I think my 20s would have been so much more enjoyable had I been, you know, I just was so clueless, and therapy was so helpful to me to free me from a lot of dysfunctional and faulty thinking.
I feel like that's such a great thing to promote on a lot of levels. One, that just being a man and, you know, being vulnerable about that and opening up. I think mental health is a big topic right now, given the current environment. But I would say even in the last 5 years, there's more of a dialogue about it, which is good, and less stigma. And, you know, we need to be connecting and talking about these things. And I think the idea of kind of connection and being in the present, and what you're talking about, you know, because I just turned 50 and I'm just now realizing some things about how much more you can enjoy the present if you're not battling old dialogue, old stories, old pain, you know, all that kind of stuff. So I really appreciate that you shared that, because I think it's a great tool, and everybody should take part in it if they can.
It's hard though. Somebody will say to you just enjoy the present, just enjoy the present. And you'll say to yourself yeah, I want to enjoy the present. But then you don't always enjoy the present. It's a life's work, I think.
It is for sure. I again, I'm so appreciative of your time. And if you come back to visit, I'd love to meet you in person and get Bolas and have Everett and Joey and hang out.
Yeah, that'd be great.
Thank you, Sean. There's so much in this interview that made an impression on me. The behind-the-scenes look at Hollywood, your personal journey and perseverance to never give up, your ability to handle rejection and keep pressing forward, your boldness to leave the comfort and security of big paychecks to follow your heart and what truly inspires you. We can't wait to see what happens next for you. A huge thank you to my producer, Missy, and thank you to all our listeners for joining us in 2021. As a reminder, if you like Relatable, please subscribe, leave comments, and rate Relatable. We can be found on most streaming platforms. Relatable is sponsored by Teresa Freeman Associates. You can follow us on Twitter and the TFA Facebook page. Until next time, this is Teresa Freeman with Relatable.